Okay, good morning. My name is Sarah Bauer, and I'm from the University of Florida. I'm really excited to be here today and share our work, which is assessing the relationship between disability and physical and communication-related barriers to healthcare services. I have no relationships to disclose. So as most of you are aware, nearly 1 in 5 people have a disability in the United States, which is approximately 57 million people, although this number is expected to grow primarily due to an aging population. Persons with disabilities are more likely to be in fair or poor health and have higher rates of risk factors for worsening overall health, such as physical inactivity and obesity. Therefore, regular, thorough healthcare visits are extremely important for this population. However, our healthcare system is not structured to care for persons with disabilities. Persons with disabilities experience lower rates of screening and more difficulty accessing services. Physical barriers are often cited as reasons persons with disabilities cannot access healthcare services. Physical barriers can include lack of transportation to the facility, physical inaccessibility of the facility itself, inaccessibility of exam rooms, or inaccessibility of equipment such as exam tables or screening equipment. In addition to physical barriers, perceived provider barriers to care also exist. Provider barriers can include poor provider attitudes and lack of knowledge about disabilities. Persons with disabilities have reported the need to teach providers about their disability and have reported feeling that all of their needs were not met during their visit. These provider barriers can also lead to brief clinical encounters or even refusal of care. So we know that access barriers exist for persons with disabilities. Barriers have been studied qualitatively in focus groups and in specific populations such as women, rural residents, and individuals with spinal cord injuries. However, our emphasis was on a more diverse population of persons with disabilities living in Florida, specifically older adults. Florida is unique in the sense that we do have an aging population and we have a mix of rural and urban areas to research. So therefore, our objective was to identify physical and communication-related barriers persons with disabilities encounter when accessing healthcare services. And we did this using the Persons with Disabilities Survey. The survey was created in 2012. It was developed by the University of Florida in partnership with the Florida Department of Health. It was a one-time random digit dial telephone survey of adults, and respondents were classified as having a disability if they responded yes to either of two questions. The first of which, are you limited in any way in any activities because of physical, mental, or emotional problems? And the second, do you now have any health problem that requires you to use special equipment such as a cane, a wheelchair, or a special telephone? So we asked respondents to indicate whether they experienced any of 8 healthcare access barriers in the previous 12 months. We used descriptive statistics to describe participant demographics, count and frequency of accessibility barriers, and we used multivariable logistic regression to assess the relationship between disability and access to care barriers. So table 1 displays the characteristics of our survey respondents. Of the 1,429 survey respondents, 471, or 33%, were classified as having a disability. Individuals with a disability were significantly older and significantly less educated than those without a disability. Additionally, individuals with a disability had significantly lower household incomes, and significantly more persons with disabilities were divorced, widowed, separated, never married, or member of an unmarried couple. Okay, so I think these results are relatively striking. So across all 8 access barriers that we inquired about, persons with disabilities were significantly more likely to report difficulty obtaining care. For example, 16% of persons with a disability reported difficulty coordinating care. 14% reported difficulty finding a provider that understood their condition. 20% of persons with a disability reported difficulty getting on an exam table, and 12% reported difficulty obtaining transportation to the healthcare facility. The majority of persons without disabilities did not report any physical or communication barriers. 98% of persons without disabilities reported zero physical barriers, and 95% of persons without disabilities reported zero communication barriers. However, nearly a third of persons with disabilities reported one or more physical barriers, and a quarter of individuals with a disability reported one or more communication barriers. Honestly, we expected to find more people reporting barriers. The counts were a little bit lower than we thought they would be. However, there was still a statistically significant difference of reporting barriers between those with and without a disability. So as I mentioned, we asked about 8 different access barriers. We chose to categorize those barriers into 4 subgroups. Those subgroups were created using face validity and based on previous literature. The first barrier subgroup we created was the physical environment barrier, which included obtaining transportation and getting into the healthcare facility. The second barrier was the clinical experience barrier, which included getting into the exam room, getting on the exam table, and getting a physical exam. The third barrier, communication and knowledge, assessed was the individual able to communicate with their provider, and did they feel as if the provider understood their condition? And then lastly, coordinating care. So each one of these barriers kind of surrounds a step in obtaining health care. Okay, so for the first barrier, which was difficulty getting transportation or getting into the healthcare facility, as I said, we use logistic regression. And instead of reporting the findings in the form of odds ratios, we decided to use adjusted predicted probabilities. So that being said, the adjusted predicted probability of encountering a physical environment barrier would be 1% if everyone in the data set were treated as if they did not have a disability. However, it would be 7% if everyone in the data set were treated as if they did have a disability. But these results were not statistically significant. Additionally, we were also interested in looking at racial and socioeconomic variation within each barrier group. So this graph displays the predicted probabilities for race and disability by income. We hypothesized that income might moderate the relationship between disability and experiencing a physical environment barrier. So along the left, the y-axis, you can see that reports the probability of experiencing a barrier, and then along the x-axis is increasing household income level. The orange line, or the topmost line, represents persons with disabilities who are also racial minorities. The red line indicates persons with disabilities who are white. The green line is persons without disabilities who are also racial minorities. And the blue line represents persons without disabilities who are white. So as you can see, across all levels of household income, individuals with disabilities who are also racial minorities have the highest probability of experiencing a physical environment barrier. Although, as household income increases, this probability is reduced. Second subgroup we looked at were the clinical experience barriers, and that included difficulty in getting into the exam room, getting on the exam table, and/or getting a physical exam. The probability that persons without a disability would encounter a clinical experience barrier was 1%, and the probability that persons with a disability would encounter a clinical experience is 14%. So these findings were a bit more profound. And this finding was statistically significant. Again, the story continues here. Individuals with a disability who are racial minorities have the highest probability of experiencing a clinical barrier. Although, as household income increases, the probability of experiencing a barrier decreases. The third barrier group was the communication and knowledge barriers, and that included experiencing difficulty communicating with your doctor and/or finding a doctor that understood your condition. So the probability that persons without a disability would experience the communication knowledge barrier was 2%, where it was 9% for those with a disability. And these findings were statistically significant. So again, we were interested in the variation within this barrier group, but here we hypothesized that education might play a role. Interestingly enough, we found that for individuals with higher level of education, they were more likely to report a barrier, a communication knowledge barrier, which I'll discuss a little bit more later. But also, again, it continues that individuals with a disability who are racial minorities continue to have the highest probability of communication and knowledge barriers. Lastly, we explored coordinating care. So the probability that individuals without a disability would experience a barrier coordinating care was 2%. It was 9% for those with a disability. So similar findings here. As you can see, individuals with higher levels of education were more likely to report difficulty coordinating care, specifically those that were college graduates. So what do these findings tell us? What does this mean? We know that individuals with disabilities have significantly higher difficulty obtaining care. And those who are racial minorities with disabilities have the highest probability of experiencing all barriers to care. Additionally, we found that lower levels of income was associated with higher probabilities of experiencing a physical environment and clinical experience barrier, which when you think about that, that makes sense because individuals with lower levels of income have less resources available to them. They're more likely to rely on public transportation, so obviously transportation is going to be difficult. For the clinical experience barrier, that included getting in the exam room, getting on the exam table, and getting a physical exam. Potentially, those individuals with lower income might have less choice of providers available to them. So that could be one potential explanation for that finding. We found that higher levels of education were associated with greater probabilities of experiencing communication and knowledge barriers and barriers coordinating care. Our thought here is that, remember, this is an individual's perception, so individuals with higher levels of education might be very, very knowledgeable about their own disability and the complexities of their condition. Therefore, they might perceive the provider to be less knowledgeable. Potentially, they also might be given less assistance, coordinating care, and they might be left to navigate the system on their own. So just potential explanations. Unfortunately, we were only able to contact individuals with a telephone, and we did target older Floridians. So unfortunately, this does limit the generalizability of our findings, but we still feel that our findings are consistent with the literature. In the future, we would like to field a larger survey to capture a larger sample. We'd like to explore interventions to address these barriers. And we really want to emphasize that communication and care coordination should not be overlooked. We feel that there's a lot of work done on the physical barriers, but communication and care coordination are also very important for persons with disabilities. Additionally, we'd like to develop approaches to reduce access disparities for persons with disabilities. I'd like to greatly thank my co-authors and contributors, and also acknowledge the CDC grant that supported this work. Thank you.
Now it's working. Okay. We have a fair amount of time for questions. Three really wonderful presentations, I thought. Who wants to start? All right. Barbara, let me bring you the mic.
Sarah, you're I'm Barbara Cornwell. I'm at FAMU, and I work with health policy and disability policy. There are studies really incredible and very useful for me as a policy person in Washington. I have some difficulty from the back room reading some of what you had, and I was
my question is, I didn't see anything broken down by gender or by. Okay, maybe there was, but I didn't recognize if it was for either of the.
We didn't. We didn't look at gender, but I think potentially in the future that would be something very interesting.
I was just wondering about the study. My name is Najee Laid. I'm a student at Melinda University. And your study in regards to the spending, I'm sorry, that was the question. Your study in regards to the big box stores increasing pain and exertion. Did you happen to look at spending and also the economic background of the participants to see if there's a correlation?
No, not yet. That's really preliminary data. So I would echo, though, that we are finding a relationship between an inverse relationship between income and barriers. So that people that have higher income have ways of mediating the barriers that they encounter. So I would echo that.
Was there another? There was another one right over here.
Thanks. Oh, hi, my name is Yochai Eisenberg from the University of Illinois in Chicago in the Department of Disability and Human Development. I had a question for Craig in terms of the time at the end there. I mean, the project as a whole is great, and I'm excited about the use of EMA. But in terms of towards the end with the time factor and thinking about, I guess to me, I thought those were higher ranges of 6 hours and 8 hours for people to be out before they went home. After exertion or after pain, and in some ways, I guess I would potentially think of the opposite finding that you had, that, you know, it's great that people are exerting themselves and not going home for that long a time, and so, kind of just, you know, I'm not sure, I guess, you know, in some ways that, you know, kind of think, I don't know, what my question is besides, you know, have you thought about, you know, it not necessarily leading to going home, but also, you know, staying out more in the community.
Well, and that's actually, the next study is the opposite, right? To look at those people who are going out and doing stuff like not going to big box stores, but going out and recreating and doing those kinds of things. And so the question then will be, do you see a similar pattern of these kinds of effects, or is it different when we flip the coin over and look at the other side? With regards to the time lag, it's really interesting because this is just taking it's empirically looking at the data and saying, what is the best predictor of people being at home? Where do we see the significance in these effects? And the arrows were longer because there were effects across, kind of, for exertion, for example, and being at home, across 4, 6, and 8 hours. So each one of those had a significant effect. But once we got to something like at-home resting, because there's a lot of reasons that people go home. One is just because they've been out. Nobody stays out forever. But if you then go to at-home resting, we get those very more specific effects where the pain is now within 2 hours. It's the time period before, if my pain goes up, I head home. The other interesting thing that we have from this is we've been working with a geographer to use that GPS data. And she broke down our group between those who were reporting very high levels of pain very consistently versus those who had more intermittent pain. And we can show now on maps, graphically, that people who have intermittent pain rarely experience pain when they're out. When they predict it, and they stay home. And most of their high pain ratings of 7 or greater happen at home. But those who have really consistent pain, they have pain when they're out because they're having pain at 7 or greater more than half of the periods, and so they're unable to, they don't have that luxury. So in terms of the driving force, there's a lot of variability in this, of course, but what we're talking about is this kind of overall effect, a 10% effect at that kind of 2-hour range for going home and resting, or that 4 to 6 hour range if you're just headed home.
I have also a question to the Greg in the first presentation. My name is Ria Suzuki from University of Michigan. And I have a question about self-reported limitation for the findings. For example, low vision people didn't show the expected finding. And I want to know how they operated the galaxy. Also, when you train 19 minutes to show how to use the devices. Is there any interaction to kind of the balance the barrier across the participants? If so, how do you control these self-reported biases?
So the variability in training, is that your second question? Because people come with variable skills for using a device like this. So your first question is, how do people with low vision use it? Well, we didn't have anybody who was completely blind, number one. Number two, what we did was we purchased both 7-inch and 10-inch tablets so we could expand the platform enormously. And then we gave people a choice about using that expanded platform. Nobody used them. Instead, they used magnifiers. So they had magnifiers that they used for other things, and they used magnifiers for operating a device. And again, there were only 10 people that were in the sample, so it's very, very small. In terms of the variability, we had a number of students. We trained in groups of 10 to 12 people, and then did those trainings, kind of four of them for 10 to 12 people would have run in a three-day period, and then they would have all started the study at the same time, essentially. So with a bunch of students and 10 to 12 people in a small group, they got a lot of individualized attention. That's the short answer.
Let me ask a question of Dr. Cole. This is EK still. I was glad you used perceived barriers because trying to characterize the existing universe of barriers would be difficult and probably foolish. But then when you were talking, I was thinking, well, what is the relationship between perceived barriers and perceived barriers to accessibility and actual accessibility? Because somebody who doesn't travel may have an outmoded notion of what the environment actually is. So, have you thought about how you might incorporate things like that into your model?
Right. In that case, I think we actually have experts from the National Center on Accessibility here. They do actually measure actual accessibility of a lot of these tourist sites and stuff, but we haven't really looked at that because in terms of this kind of study, in terms of primary data collection, we can only ask about their perceptions. But actually, I think that's a good idea to really look at what are the actual level accessibility really is. But we have not looked at that. But I do think that is probably going to be very important thing to look at actually down the road.
Sure, you're in the University of Florida, and I have a question about the EMA, which I thought was a fascinating study and really has a lot of potential. One question has to do with the people that are characterized as having memory impairments. What was the actual question? Was it just a memory, or I thought it had something to do with other types of
I'll read it to you. It is because of a physical, mental, or emotional condition, do you have serious difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it could be other things besides memory itself.
Yes.
Okay.
True enough.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't tease it out more than that.
So they're answering yes, I have this impairment.
Okay. And then the second question, just for clarification, for pain, even though you measured it by intensity or degree, did you measure like the type of pain, like if it was joint pain versus a migraine?
No.
Okay. Those would be interesting things to look at.
And just as by way of study, we had to keep our eye on the prize with the study, which was we were looking at participation. We kept drifting into pain questions because we had those same questions as we're putting it together, and I had to keep bringing the research team back saying, but our endpoint here is participation. Pain is just, we're just going to start to unpack this. But I think the pain literature would suggest you would find differential effects for different kinds of pain. Some pain is more limiting than others.
And how connected to the environmental situation and your assessment?
Yeah.
And you found on a scale of 0 to 10, the average was what, 4?
4.5.
4.5, and you didn't select for pain at all. So this is a supposedly representative sample for disabilities, which is really striking.
Hi, I'm Kim Phillips from the University of New Hampshire Institute on Disability. Craig, I probably missed this in your presentation, but I find myself wondering, what was your referent group? You had that table where it was greater than, lower than, and then there were some
red boxes, but...
So there's not a reference group in that. That was a median test. So we're just talking about greater than the median, or was it a bigger problem for people of a particular impairment group? So it's just looking at comparing the median using a man with EU.
Okay, thank you. And was it the median of each disability type?
So yes or no to each of those questions. So like the memory cognitive group, it's comparing those with versus those without, regardless of any other impairment.
Right. Okay. Thank you. And I think it would be really interesting to do this with a control group as well. Mm-hmm. As you're talking about, what kinds of problems, and you showed the list, I was thinking how many of those irritate me when I'm out, and I wouldn't necessarily say yes to any of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be interesting in the future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Hi, my name is Peter Scow, from the University of Minnesota. Also a question for Greg. I'm thinking about framing barriers and facilitators to participation. And I see yours as framed as barriers. Can you explain that to me a little bit and how you might see facilitators? And I'm thinking particularly about social invitation. So I don't see that no one invited me as a barrier.
Mm-hmm. So the endpoint in our study is to look at the relative contributions of those environmental conditions versus pain, and trying to get at things like the proportion of people, time people spend at home, just as an example. Or when we flip it around, we'll be looking at how much they're going out. So with that, it's just a matter of, it's EMA, you got 22 questions, you want people to answer this in 2 to 3 minutes and be done. And so we just decided for simplicity's sake to just keep it in kind of the problem domain. But to understand facilitators would be a great extension of it.
Hi, my name is Amanda Botticello. I'm with Kessler Foundation in New Jersey and the Rutgers New Jersey Medical School. First of all, this was a fascinating panel. Really, really well done. Sorry to keep on the EMA because they were all great talks. But I have one question, actually two, one logistics. In terms of recruiting for this study and privacy concerns, I know you mentioned there was one person you didn't want to be tracked. But you went, from 10,000 households, which I think you said you expected 13% to have a disability, and then to 116. So I was wondering if in the screening process, a lot of people who dropped a postcard may have expressed discomfort for this kind of work, and how you navigated that challenge?
So we initially selected for the survey, right? So we weren't selecting in our initial 10,000 households. We're asking for people to complete a survey, and we're offering them a small incentive to do it. So that's the 525 that returned the survey. And then the last question of the survey is about the EMA. And it was simply a question about, would you participate in another study? So we selected from that group and then began calling people up. And there were some people that mostly it was around just not having the time to come and do the training and to do this. We did not find nearly as much discomfort as you would expect, even with the GPS, even with using the devices, because we did some pilot work thinking, well, we're going to have to do a lot of work because people aren't going to really want to use these. Not true. People really liked them, and we bought a number of these. I think we had 50 of these devices that we purchased. We only lost one, and it was the woman left the training and slammed it in her car door. We got the screen replaced, and we were done. They brought them back. We did pay them $50 for their participation. But your point is, isn't there some kind of selection in this? Absolutely. I mean, we're doing our best to be population-based, but these are people that are, they're interested in research, and they're interested in being a high responder. So that's definitely a limitation.
Yeah, well, no, that's great to know. I also had a question, and I may have missed this in your talk. What percentage of your respondents were employed, and do you think there was any kind of moderating effect in terms of, things that I've looked at in my research, people who leave the house for work tend to be absent if they leave the house, and regardless of pain and so forth.
Yeah, and so if you go to work, if you have pain, you still go to work. Because you have to be at work. And so I did present it. I don't remember it off the top of my head. I think it was around 37% were not employed at all, and then we had some part-time, and maybe 30% or so were full-time employed.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you definitely see that if you look over weekdays and weekends, people who are employed are participating, they're going out more all the time. They're out more on weekends as well.
Hi, my name is Allison, and I'm with the University of Michigan. I have one cousin in Chicago and one cousin in Sarah. I'm knowing a bit about me and people who have mobility issues. I was wondering if you have considered exploring other types of disability that come from the disability or even adopting chronic hearing.
Yeah, no, we haven't really looked at other types of disability yet, but I think that in terms of travels, really, I think there's a lot more room with different types of disabilities to understand that, but we haven't really looked at that because we are only looking at very homogeneous group as now. It's very exploratory, and also in the literature, there's really not much research has done on any type of travel linking with people with disabilities. It's very limited. So it's purely exploratory at this stage. But of course, accessibility issues that's encountered by different types of disabilities, for example, people who are blind or deaf or other types of, they might have different kind of barriers.
And if you could be about, please let me know.
Yes, I will.
I'll
see you at the card.
Sarah, you provided questions if you could give me how to identify anyone who has disability. Did you also identify what kind of disability they have? And if so, do you plan on exploring the differences between the disability group and what their barriers were?
Thank you for your question. We did not. Our hope was to identify a diverse, kind of broad group of individuals with disabilities, but we did not specify the type of disability that the individual had. Potentially in the future, I think, of course, that would be important to explore.
And I wanted to mention that I know someone who was doing a study on the language barriers that can kind of turn people out.
When you choose to participate in certain activities, you have this exchange of information, which is your internal needs with external condition. So that's how it works to make that decision whether, or at least what this model is suggesting, then make your decision. So when we're looking at the accessibility on its own, it's probably not going to see, if you change a condition, make a place accessible, that probably doesn't immediately see the same kind of linear relationship will increase participation directly. Because there's these internal factors, we have to think and see how they interact and eventually determines how whether I will consider participation or not.
Thank you.
So this model is mainly suggesting, the implying that the participation decision has this, include this exchange of internal and external information.
I have another question for Dr. Cole. I might have missed this in the presentation, but was your unit of analysis the trip or the person? Because in some ways I was thinking, you know, a lot of times a person's motivation might change depending on the trip. And so, you know, depending on how you analyze it, you know, it might be different.
Right. We did measure in trip measures in terms of how many specific trips and see what are the predictor variables. But in this case, we're looking at a person unit because it's more their likelihood to continue travels, not looking at the actual participation in terms of number of trips in this particular one. So it's more their their reported intention, self-reported intention to travel, so a person. Not specific in the number of trips.
I guess I wasn't necessarily thinking number of trips, but just that each individual trip represents a different motivation. Like, you know, the trip to theme park is might be intrinsic, and the trip to grandma's cabin
could
be extrinsic.
Right.
And then, you know, there'd be different variables.
Right. So ideally, you know, when we're doing travels, ideally we would be very trip specific. For example, you would probably collect data at a resort or at a Disney World. So looking at this particular trip was the reason. That's ideally. But because of limitation in terms of the number amount of people, we can actually collect data. So this was really asking about very general perception. And generally, when you travel for the way we define it is for fun, for vacation, and then for entertainment. So, very general.